thank you. Thank you. And for those of you who know me, I'm a man of little words, right? It's fun to be here. Thank you, Allison, for the invitation and for the committee asking me to do this. I saw those pictures of Cal Poly, and it made me homesick for my spring in 2000 when I implemented the first applications in biotechnology class at Cal Poly in the undergraduate program in animal science. And it's great to see good friend Mike Hall here today and was part of that in making that happen. Is it okay? There we go. So when Allison asked me to give this talk, she said, I want you to come up with something that's an exciting title. And I got to thinking about my life in animal science and growing up in the Horn and Pold Hereford business and all the things that I've done, but it's genetic gain full throttle. And this is what's happened, and I think about my whole life, and I think about many of you in this room. Animal breeding has been about genetic gain full throttle as we go back to the 40s and 50s, and you'll see in the slides as we talk about that with some of the things that have happened. But it's an exciting time, and these things are coming together like they always do, and us as scientists will promise the moon and excitement. But I've seen in the last 15, 20 years as I went back to grad school and in my career at Clay Center and then Pfizer and now at Transova Genetics, the merging of all these technologies and the rate of gain. And we're going to talk a lot about the dairy industry today and show you how that industry has captured that technology and that. And the beef industry oftentimes follows suit as we move through this. Which is the forward. I want to do this. It's not doing it on the computer either. This is... These two? There we go. So this first slide I have to put up now, as some of you are probably aware, Transova a year ago was acquired or purchased by a company called Intrexon, and so since we're a publicly traded company, we have to put this up. But the bottom line is it's a neat story, and I'd love to tell it to you if you're very interested, but about some individuals and a vet clinic that started out of a garage and a lot of businesses that spun out of that and the opportunity and entrepreneurship and the American dream and getting to see that and be part of that happening has been a lot of fun. But we are the same people, same places, same products, but we have a lot of access to a lot of really neat science, and our R&D programs are expanding a lot. And that's been a real fun thing with our Intrexon becoming part of the Intrexon family. So this is the reproductive toolbox that gets me really excited. This is a toolbox that all of you have a lot of access to and have use pieces of this. And really the only thing that's not active in the industry right now is this precision breeding piece that was mentioned today. And I can get really excited about that, and that's a future piece. And as we see animals and we talk about editing animals and just moving natural occurring alleles around in populations, making a Y-goo that has the Piedmontese myostatin allele, those type of things, making a horned animal, a cloned copy of it that's polled, which is already actually proof of concept has been done, and that calf is alive and living already. As this happens, this is going to add to this toolbox and the things we can do and we can think about with these elite genetic lines and the things that we can think about in fixing deleterious mutations and before we put those animals to market. And a lot of just fun stuff. But the toolbox and all these areas and how they're intertwined and how when I'm working with different breeders and things, talking about, it's not any one given piece of this toolbox that accelerates genetic gain and gives everybody and gives you a particular advantage. It's how you use the bits and pieces that fit your program and make them work. And I'll be the first to say that in vivo flushing, that we still do thousands of in vivo flushes a year, hasn't changed the numbers that we do for probably 5 to 10 years at Transova. We do a lot more IVF procedures, but those two coupled hand in hand work together and can be used in maximizing embryo transfer program production as an example. So this is the pyramid of associated reproductive technologies, and we can think about it the historical perspective, but I would argue with anybody that this was probably the single biggest advancement in biotechnology and animal agriculture was our ability to do artificial insemination and the ability to freeze sperm. And the rest of these technologies are a result of that and still are very intertwined. And we think about the pyramid of technology and how that all goes. They all complement each other and work very well hand in hand in maximizing, accelerating genetic gain. And of course, the equation that is an animal breeder in the room, myself, that is so true and dear to our hearts, is this genetic gain equation, and it's this genetic variation that's segregating in a population. We hope there's lots of it there so we can move traits or groups of traits in different directions. It's this accuracy that's changed a lot with the advent of with the advent of higher density genomic chips and incorporating this genotypic information into our genetic evaluations. We now have accuracy of selection in animals at much younger age. And as Fernando and Pablo were talking about, what if we back that all the way up even to the embryo and start thinking about even of, and maybe even backing it up even to a concept of working with fetuses and that. And we'll talk a little bit about this at the end of the talk and how we can move generation by changing generation interval with these reproductive technologies, because we have tools to help accurately select. It's not perfect, but it's better than the information we had before. If we're using population genetics, we can drive selection if we're not putting all of our marbles in the basket of one animal. And, of course, selection intensity is what, how elite are we getting in that population? Are we the top 1%, 10th of a percent, 5%, whatever that is? So why do we use these tools? And this has been said over and over. It's to make lots and lots of opportunities out of these elite high genetic merit females and with those high elite genetic males. And this is a picture of Ashlyn, a famous dairy cow that was a World Expo dairy champion back in the 2005-06 era. I think if you look her up, she's got 300 to 400 females registered in the American Holstein breed out of her. We still make embryos out of her that I don't know, probably about the 10th different group has owned her, and she is still highly prolific and makes lots and lots. This is a picture of, I think, 4 different IVF procedures. All those heifer calves were born in about a 40-day window of each other and to 4 different bulls, and kind of fun. So we talked a lot about IVF, and there's no need for me to go into details in that, but the lot of the things that make it slightly different than with flushing is we have this ability to either aspirate cows every week or every other week. Every other week works really well. But we have these different things with open, these extremely young females. Our nucleus programs that we do for ourselves and some of the AI studs, we're starting these dairy heifers at 7 months of age. We're trying to push that window even earlier. So really, she's not quite old enough to even get pregnant and have a calf, and she's got calves on the ground before she's ever even been able to have a calf. The ability to do females that are pregnant and managing elite donor females, being able to have a calf, flush her once, get her pregnant, do a few rounds of IVF on her, and keep her in that annual calving cycle is just huge and a great, great tool. But the options and opportunities with fertilization and a lot of different things. This is just a quick schematic, and we've covered it quite a bit in the previous two discussions, but basically the difference between an in vivo flush and an in vitro is we've now taken the incubator out of the cow, we've taken the fertilization procedure out of the cow. It's controlled in the lab. And I'll be the first to say that when you take that out of the cow, it doesn't ensure that you're going to be able to do it better. When you take technology at this level, and in vitro fertilization has become fairly mainstream across the world, but it is a very, very technical, takes a lot of science and a lot of very skilled people involved in that and a lot of great quality controls in that, in making that process happen. Sex semen, which Vish talked about, and it plays a huge role in all this genetic improvement, being able to skew sex ratios one way or the other. The primary way that we use sorted semen at Transova in frozen sexed, and also we can take a frozen straw of semen on almost any bull that's been put up conventionally. Sort X or Y bearing sperm and fertilize with an IVF, and is a product that we do a lot of for a lot of different. Not every bull has frozen sex semen available. Delivering this technology to lots and lots of places where there are lots and lots of cows has really been what Transova has done a lot of in the last decade. Transova's headquarters are located in Sioux Center. We house a large amount of donor cows, a dairy calf facility where we gestate and raise dairy calves for a lot of nucleus producers in the U.S. About 2,000 to 3,000 dairy calves are delivered every year out of that program. And our IVF labs our biggest IVF lab is in Iowa. We have an IVF lab and donor facility in Maryland. An IVF lab and donor facility in Texas. We also have a large cow-calf operation that we run in Fletcher, Oklahoma. We have we produce 2,000 to 2,500 weaned beef calves for our clients a year along with the donor facility. This is the oldest donor and recipient housing facility next to the original headquarters in Chillicothe, Missouri. What's different about now are all these blue dots and how we've evolved IVF technology and bringing it to the cow herds. These are day satellites, and these might be a vet clinic, they might be a large dairy anchor client, or a lot of them are actually ET practitioners that our team of a vet and an embryologist will go there every other week, aspirate cows that are scheduled. We overnight the oocytes, either courier or UPS or FedEx, back to and actually this is a schematic of that. We send out OPUtenes, we do the OPUs on the cows, they come back to the regional IVF centers, one of three. We make embryos, they can either go into multiple of our recipient programs that we have that are primarily beef cow based, but we last year sent probably upwards close to 100,000 embryos back to other ET practitioners to transfer into their clients and our clients' cows. And so the ability to transport fresh embryos, frozen embryos, and around the U.S. with UPS and FedEx has worked very, very well. These incubators have the ability to heat and cool based on whatever the outside temperature is, and has been a system that's worked very, very well. So this is, and I said we're going to talk about dairy, and a lot of what we're going to talk about on the genetics piece now, and that is relates to dairy, but the beef industry is right there with it, with the technologies as they're being developed. But this is what's happened in the dairy industry. Young females are qualified with Illumina, with the genomic, one of the density of the chips. I use the old 50K since I was part of the USDA team in the University of Missouri in Alberta that brought that first chip to a deal, so I come my heart kind of to the old original chip. But with they select these elite females based on their genetic merit value, which has been includes the genomic information in that. We collect juvenile heifers. We'll push the envelope right now as low as 7 months and working on the ability to take that even younger. We'll fertilize then with either sexed or conventional semen and then gestate embryos. And this program is, I call the genetic race, and you might see that word race used on a lot of slides in the dairy industry, and you'll see some results. How ART and genomic selection has it changed the marketing of cattle in the dairy industry, in the nucleus sector, and the rate of genetic gain has just exploded. So what's changed? This hasn't changed. When we think about genetics, this hasn't changed. We make a phenotype, and it has two components, environmental and genetic. And some of these we know and we can control, and some of them we never have an idea, we can't control. But with great modeling and using blood type analyses and that, we can sort enough of this out. If we have great progeny test programs with cattle in lots of different environments, we can do a really good job of accounting for part of this and getting it more of this true genetics piece. Now, most of our national genetic evaluations are focused and have been developed through the additive, but there we'll start seeing some non-additive type pieces of that genetic equation. But this system works really, really well, and it's the things that add to this that allow us to have these national genetic evaluations in beef going back to about 1985 in the U.S. With the first genetic evaluations, that they get better and better as we go, and we just keep adding information to it. This is most of this, I can even say, happened in my life. A lot of it was going on for hundreds of years before that. But the evolution of how the tools and what we have, and you think about the genetic evaluation evolution, which we think back to with visual appraisal and to where we really started then tracking pedigree information, performance data. And I remember the TPR programs of the 70s as a kid growing up, and we were looking at ratios within herd before we had EPDs and understanding the variation and ratioing different bulls, progeny testing different sets of calves, and that was how huge it was. When 85, when we started getting in here, when we started having our national genetic evaluations in beef, dairy would have been ahead of that a number of years. Things really started changing. And when you see accuracy or reliability in these slides, I like to think of it as progeny equivalence. How many progeny test calves, basically with phenotypic data, have been represented for that animal to help us get at its true genetic merit? And that's the big piece, the accuracy of the equation. But it's as we move through these tools, and indexes are huge, and if you're not using an index, you need to really, really look at what is the indexes I need to work with, who do I need to work with to help me if I need to customize indexes, whatever it is. Multiple trait selection using indexes keep us from making huge, huge mistakes and staying away from single trait selection, which we seem to do over and over. But we like things that are extreme, and it's easy to select for big high numbers or really, really low numbers. But so as we look at the tools and what's happened with DNA and our ability to manage these genetic defects as they pop up, targeted panels from that sense, I mean, where the contributions are really big, where we have smaller sets of markers focused in on a single trait, but they're still fairly large and are complementing that. But we've drilled in on hundreds or maybe a few thousand markers in these targeted panels. And, of course, the high density panels, and we get to a crossbreed and blended evaluations. And this little piece called imputation that allows us to take a lower density, say 17,000 markers, which back in 1995 when I was, or 97 when I went back to grad school, if we talked about 5,000 markers in a mouse model, they would have called that ultra-high density, but we were happy with 300 markers covering the genome when we would do those initial scans for these regions that were impacting these different traits in mice and cattle. But this is an area where we can use a lower density and we can impute up to the 50K. So if we have parental and related animal information, we have the ability to take smaller, cheaper amounts of genotyping information, say 10,000, 17,000 markers, impute up to the 50K, and actually get genomic-enhanced EPDs and work well. And the dairy industry has been utilizing this for a number of years now, and it's having a huge impact in the commercial sector, as we'll see as we go through this. This is a slide that I've used for years. Allison has seen it going way, way back. I haven't updated it for probably 2 years, but this is a parent average of a couple of bulls that are famous old Angus bulls that exist. If there's one thing you come out of this talk with is full sibs are not identical. And I'm whopping 5'8", 5'9", and my brother, for those of you who know him, is 6'2". And I do know we do have the same parents. We are full sibs, but there is great variation. And so just because you have a flush of calves and they're all full sibs doesn't mean that they're all created equal. And that's really what this is about, and this is a great example of it. But these are two famous Angus bulls that were born a year apart, full sibs. And they, this would have been parent average. But what was known about these two bulls now is with super high BIF accuracies, this would be literally hundreds of thousands of progeny. These are really high accuracies. This bull is about as low growth calving ease, and this guy is at the other end of the spectrum. However, is a severely a big growth bull. And so two full sibs, way away from their parent average or the parent average that they would have been for the traits of interest that we posted here. And so how does that happen? It's a little thing called Mendelian sampling, that when you take two animals, in this case we have an elite bull and an elite female, if we can make 1,000 progeny, measure them for let's say a trait like a yearling weight, which is a trait that tends to not be as noisy as a lot of other traits, you're going to get a distribution that looks like this, and you're going to have some individuals that are nowhere close to that parent average, but you're going to have some of these individuals that are sitting out here like 3 standard deviations away from the mean that are those elite 1% that are moving that forward. If you use population genetics and you do sets of animals and matings in that, you'll move that whole population. But there's going to be this variation, hence why full sibs are not created equal. So historically, when we think back through it and we think about we had pedigrees and production records and that worked great, but what was killing us is generation lag, right? We always have had this situation where we had to wait for animals to be proven. And in the dairy industry, you're talking first proofs came back at about 6 years, 5 or 6 years of age on those bulls with their daughters having milk production records. This slows genetic change down, but how the system worked. With the advent of bringing DNA information to the genetic evaluations and adding to that, we add this accuracy, this reliability, progeny equivalence. We now can make selection on these young animals, and if we're using population genetics and selecting the high of the high, it's going to get a lot of them right. It might not get a few of them just perfect when they progeny test them, but it's going to get a good bulk of them right and much more predictability. And if you're in beef breeds that have access to genomic-enhanced EPDs, it's an added tool of information that you have that gives you more prediction than you had before. It might not be as high as Holstein, where the day a Holstein calf is born and we get back the genomic-enhanced genetic merit values is somewhere between 35 and 40 daughter milk records for that particular trait. But it still has progeny equivalence for certain traits. It gives you way more information and an idea of which way that animal's genetic merit is going to drift to, its true genetic merit, if we could produce 1,000 progeny. So it's a wonderful, wonderful tool. So what happened in the dairy industry when you couple this with ART? This is how this really, really changed in the point that I don't know if I'm making very well, but these full sibs used to be, this is how full sibs were valued in the dairy industry. And if I had a elite cow that was a really high genetic merit listed female, I would use ART technology and I'd create a set of full sibs out of her, and this would be the parent averages for net merit of the calves born out of her. And everybody would fight over the first pick. And they have nothing to go on other than to phenotypically look at this little tiny heifer calf or bull calf and say, yep, I have first pick that I've just paid $50,000 for, and it's going to be that one. And the next guy might have second pick at $40,000. And the way that worked, well, when you think about the bulls and you look at the reshuffling, oftentimes the guy with the fifth pick ended up with the one when they progeny proved out to be the highest. This changed, though, with adding genomics to the genetic evaluation. We now have enough progeny equivalent information to make better selection decisions because of the DNA that's added to the evaluation. And these full sibs suddenly have differences in their genetic predicted genetic merits. And this is the index net merit. And you start having options that the top 10%, let's say, of that hit a certain range, they're going to go back into an ART program with IVF or in vivo and keep pushing the envelope. We might breed the middle ones to some sex semen to raise replacements in our operation, and then the bottom ones we might use for recipients or culls. And that's what's wild about what's happened is these elite matings get made. We collect DNA on or a tissue sample on those calves the day they're born. It goes off for genotyping. So every now we're seeing turnarounds with the. With the weekly dairy evaluation, sometimes the calves are 14 to 18 days of age, and the client or ourselves have the genetic merits back on them. The calves that aren't hitting a certain bar suddenly have commercial grade value. So it's changed the value proposition and how these animals are marketed and what these animals are worth. A really high animal, one or two, might be worth $100,000. And then that same flush of calves or group of calves made in an ART situation might have a value of about $2,200. A commercial grade heifer. And that's really restacked how that industry works and how that, you know, the game is played or the race is done in that. And it's not for the faint of heart and can take some resources, but it's happening at such a fast pace and is accelerating and going so fast. But this is what combining those technologies has done to that industry. It's obvious in the promotion and stuff, and you see this is just coming from a website and an individual with a website that tracks a lot of this stuff, but it's the race and how these companies and the investment in their nucleus populations and the nucleus producers and that and the way they're producing these cattle, and it's a genetic change like I said, full throttle. This was something we pulled together back when the April 2014 list of young sires came out. And we'll go through and look through the list and sit there and look and say, oh, wow, we made the first and the fifth and the tenth. And so we were going through the list and realizing that we either, our technology or the clients that had produced them, we do work for those clients. And 87% or 87 out of the top 100 were involved at Transova, or we had made those calves, and it was like you started realizing the impact of the technologies and what you're doing in the industry. To put this in a sense of what's happened with genetic gain, and we think about it, how it's been accelerated, this is what's happened with generation interval, and this is some I pulled out of a paper from the USDA that was just earlier this year. But when we look at what's happened, this is the age, parent ages of marketed Holstein bulls. Look what happened. So here in 09 is when the first genetic evaluations were released, genomic enhanced evaluations. And look what's happened to the age of the sires for the bulls that are on the market. And the females have had a similar type thing as it continues to decrease. Generation intervals being accelerated. Young bulls are siring the next generation, and young females are the dams of the next generation. And so we oftentimes will be sent semen that is not even of high enough quality to go out and be used in the industry, but we'll use it in IVF so that company can start making embryos on a young, young bull, Jersey or Holstein, to be ahead of the curve on generation interval as soon as it starts working. But what you can see happened, and I have a slide that I probably should have pulled out that shows this in crops and shows a very similar pattern of genetic selection and corn yield and with stacking the technologies that takes you into the 90s. But you see before our genomic evaluation, we were making a net merit increase on that of about $19 a year as you looked at genetic selection or genetic gain going on in Holstein. That's pretty good. I mean, that's a lot when you think about it. Here's where genomic selection, enhanced genetic merit values hit, where it began. The improvement in the technologies, and it's ramping up a little bit. But here's 09 where that started. I'll get my eyes right here. And you can see it really take off, and we're almost a twofold increase, and not quite what we've seen happen. Some of that is just the accuracy and the parental data that's going into these genetic evaluations now. These animals have to go through a pipeline. You have all this DNA markers. They have to pass all their parentage. That cleaned up a lot of things and some that was lagging and pulling back on our genetic evaluations. And a lot of it is these young animals, generation interval, and cranking genetic merit at an extremely fast rate. The dairy industry looks like this at the present, and it'll probably change in years to come and slightly, but now we're using young donors and oftentimes extremely young males, producing these elite males. The females are cycled back into the nucleus program of the very, very elite that actually qualify. These bulls are producing the next generation and then going into commercial semen production, which actually is producing the daughters that produce all the milk and everything along here. I think we'll continue to see that push and acceleration. We're already starting to see there's one of the AI studs in the U.S., but I'm sure other ones will start to, limiting what sex of semen is on the market. And they're only releasing X-bearing semen on the market and holding all the Y. Making sure, and it's brilliant, it goes back to what we did before we had artificial insemination. You had to come to a ranch to buy a son of a bull. And these groups and nucleuses and the nucleus things that control a lot of the bulls, they're going to make sure that everybody doesn't have access to that high bull, because the chance of you making the next high son, unless you have some kind of lead on them, is less, because Mendelian sampling and everybody using thousands of straws on a bunch of elite cows, on sheer probability, you might not produce the next high son. And this is a way to start assuring that the genetics that you've worked so hard to capture and produce on the male side, you can continue to harness that. So what's happened in the commercial dairy sector? Well, because of this huge database and this data, DHIA, and the way they collect milk data and that, and with the industry for years progeny testing in commercial operations, and that information is contributing to those genetic evaluations and something the beef industry really needs to think about. There are a lot of traits that come from straight bred populations, and if we could get across the crossbreed EPD thing, that we could be harnessing a lot more data. And that's going to add power and accuracy to genomic enhanced genetic merit technology. But the dairy commercial industry has been able to harness this. And you can take a dairy calf, have no idea, like a straight Holstein or straight Jersey, what the sire and dam is, have it genotyped with a lower density and pewed up to the 50K and get genetic enhanced genetic merit values back that allow you to make replacement heifer selection decisions, allow you to do these things. It's been a game changer. And right now, when you look at the number, this was back in June, this is the number of genotyped Holsteins from the CDCB, which does the National Dairy Evaluation, used to be what we referred to as the USDA group and that did the evaluation. We're sitting up here at almost 900, it's probably pushing it pretty close now, 900,000 genotyped Holsteins. A big, big part of that is becoming these commercial animals that are being genotyped in genetic merit, and management and selection decisions in the commercial dairy are being made utilizing that information. As you can see to date, this is all breeds and dairy. This is, I'm guessing, we probably just will eclipse it or about did. I haven't looked in this month, but a million animals genotyped in the dairy for those main breeds and dairy that are using genomic enhanced genetic merit values. So this is getting back to, and I referred to it earlier, but the genetic improvement, the race, and these young animals. And I think the beef industry right now probably doesn't have quite, for a lot of our traits and a lot of our genomic enhanced EPDs, we don't have something quite comparable to Holstein. But we have some ways to think about using this technology and not putting all your marbles in the young animal basket, but ways to do some things with genetic selection and genetic gain, and thinking about pushing the envelope in different ways of doing that, and generation interval being the biggest limiting factor in this equation. And as these accuracies improve and stuff, I think it gets really exciting, the things we can do. What's that done for ART in the U.S.? Well, this is processed embryos or produced embryos by month for Transova going back to, this would be 09, and this is this year. And I didn't have time to update the figure, but this was the month of May, and we produced over 27,000 embryos at Transova, grade 1 and grade 2 embryos, either in vivo or IVF. And so it's incredible to see the uptake of technology. The dairy industry is probably 65% of the ART that we do, and the beef industry is probably about 35%. But the uptake of these technology in beef is probably where the dairy industry was about 6 years ago, and watching how that happens. What we've seen in the technology, and I say all these things start colliding in the ability to do these kind of things, is this is embryo production, the blue bars of IVF going back to 07 for Transova. This was 14. We're up here in the almost 6. This year we're running 6.3 embryos on on thousands and thousands of OPU events. And this is the flush, if you look at the AETA data in the U.S. on the flush data, but this is Transova data, we're usually somewhere between about 5.5 and about 6.5 on embryos produced in vivo flushes. And you take this with the ability to do 4 to 7 embryos every other week, you can really move things fast in producing quite a few progeny out of a given cow. Everybody always asks about cloning and where that technology is. We probably over the last 5 years continue to produce about the same number of cattle clones with beef and dairy. Most of the clients that utilize that technology, it's these leading terminal sires and foundation females, so to say, that they just need to make more progeny out of. The genetic outliers that die extremely young and they haven't had a chance to contribute to the population like they potentially could. This happened with the first Angus defect, people going back and having some really, really old cows that the majority of their progeny had been sired by carriers, and they wanted to produce more and went back to those old cows and did some cloning there. And of course, then these proven performers that are in extremely high demand. This is an example of a Holstein bull that the originator, the genetic donor, I should say, was sick as a calf, respiratory, horrible semen producer, had predicted high genetic merit. Genomics came along. He looked really, really good. The AI company cloned him. The calf was extremely healthy, great semen production, and there's been thousands of calves born around him, born out of this bull that would have never contributed to the genetic pool in the world. Biotechnology and then gene editing is something we mentioned, and we have the opportunity at Transova. We work with and do the animal husbandry side for some really cool cows that have the ability to make human antibodies in their blood, and we learn a lot from working with these type of models. Also with medical model pigs, a company that we helped start called Exemplar, where they go into a cell line, they create a mutation in a gene that mirrors a phenotype like cystic fibrosis, and then we make cloned embryos of those, and they raise pigs that then the medical field uses. And from these type of technologies, we learn a lot about how when these type of technologies add to that toolbox and become commercialized, how we can do that and ways to do that, and a lot about culture systems and science as a whole. But this is a neat area and a fun area, and Transova active in that area to continue staying on top of the science. This is a project that we started about, those calves are a year old now, so it's getting on 2 years ago, but we were in the process of trying to establish cell lines from IVF 7-day-old embryos, which we now have finally gotten to that point. Efficiency-wise, Pablo and us are working on, can we do it even better than we do it? But we decided at that point when we weren't making progress, we went ahead and created IVF embryos out of this. In this case, it was a Jersey donor, a handful of Jersey donors. We transfer 5 or 6 embryos into a single beef recipient. We come in here at about day 21 to day 24, and we flush out the fetuses that are there. And from those fetuses, we establish these fibroblast cell lines. And so establishing a cell line from a fetus has been done for years and years. It's very robust. We grow up enough cell lines that we can take a tube from that, or an aliquot of that cell line, and extract high quality DNA and genotype it, send it in for genotyping, off to the genetic evaluation for the dairy evaluation. And we have these cell lines sitting there. We get the genomic enhanced genetic merit values back, And lo and behold, we had this cell line that was the second highest Jersey bull for an index we were interested in that had never existed. So we went ahead with the cloning process, thawed out that cell line, and made 15 embryos, transferred them into beef recipients, and ended up with five nice, healthy bull calves. And that's these five Jersey bull calves right here that were born a year ago June that are living at an AI stud right now. But showing that backing generations up, thinking how far can we push the envelope back? We're still in the process. We utilize this technology some in our internal populations right now. We're in the process modeling it and seeing is it robust enough that it's something that we should be utilizing at a commercial level in our selection programs. And that comes down to a point of robust enough. Are you saving enough money trying to find those outlier cell lines with the costs that are incurred in over the system that we have now with that gain and generation interval? And it comes down to a matter of economics. We've done a huge amount in the R&D group. I lead a group related to embryos with biopsy and genomics and that are coupled to all of this, and have done a lot of, and it was fun to see with Fernando, a lot of the things that he has seen and done when we've biopsied upwards of 2,500 to 3,000 embryos, looking specifically at allele dropout and allele biasing and ways to get around that and things that we can do to enhance getting lots of DNA, lots of high-quality DNA, and how we can move that forward. At the same time, I'm working on some models right now. Not every embryo is biopsiable. So when you biopsy embryos and you start looking at what you have in front of you, if you produce six embryos, three or four might be biopsiable. You're doing something that is going to probably hurt your preg rate a little bit, and then you freeze it, and all these little intrusive things. And so you save these, you make a selection decision, you put in these highs, and then probably the three or four highest ones that you're so excited about never come to be. And maybe knowing that is even worse. Or you have this live calf you're gestating. But there's all these mental pieces of it along with the economic pieces of it. But I think as the efficiencies continue to get better and better, it is something that could play into it. The first biopsied embryo work goes back to a paper back in 1992, Brian Kirkpatrick from University of Wisconsin published in sexing embryos. And we've done it off and on through the years in ART with in vivo embryos at different phases with looking at sec, PCR-based single, kind of assay, diagnostic assays, looking at stuff, coat color, different things. It's been a commercial product at times for different companies, and there's kind of a blip. Everybody goes, well, if I can't do all of them, maybe we just need to put them all in and not hurt our preg rate and stuff. And so is that will continue to evolve, but efficiencies and work like that Pablo and Fernando are doing is going to help contribute to making that a more commercially viable thing. So as we look to the future and we pull all these technologies together and we think about the opportunity is huge. And I just don't think for the nucleus sector. I mean, everything starts at the nucleus sector, but I think we have opportunities with these technology in the commercial sector also and bringing it. And with economies of scale and time and these things, costs come down, but genetic gain and having to feed the world, when we think about what we got to do over the next 50 years, we will have to use these technologies at a scale and ability to compete, but more so an ability just to feed everybody on the planet. And so I think with that, I hopefully haven't kept everybody too long from lunch. And if we have any time, I'll attempt to answer any questions.